when the shades of night are falling, comes a fellow everyone knows. It's the old dope peddler, spreading joy wherever he goes. Every evening you will find him around our neighborhood. It's the old dope peddler, doing well by doing good. He gives the kids free samples because he knows full well that today's young innocent faces will be tomorrow's clientele. Here's a cure for all your troubles. Here's an end to all distress. It's the old dope peddler with his powdered happiness.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Ben Calhoun talk about former congressional representative from South Carolina, Bob Ingus. And then later, Ira Glass talks to writer and activist Bill McKibben.
Do you know personally Republican members who find the science credible but would never say so publicly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Can you name them?
No, I better not do that. But I can't out them. But there are members of Congress, Republicans who know better, but they're afraid of crossing what's become the orthodoxy. This winter, I was visiting in the gym, the House gym in Washington, a couple months ago, and a member of Congress, and I were talking, and
this is a Republican member.
Republican member of Congress. We were talking, and we had some discussion about what's going on in Congress, and then he asked me at the end, "Now, what are you doing again?" And so I told him, I'm doing this thing of, trying to convince conservatives as a conservative answer to energy and climate.
Bob says at that moment, the Republican congressman he was talking to paused. Then he looked back over one shoulder, and then over the other. And then he turned back to Bob.
He says to me, "Yeah, we got to get right on that, don't we?" And he sort of gave me a knowing nod and a wink and just walked away.
I talked to Republican staffers from both houses. Some said Bob's right, that more Republicans believe the science than will say so publicly. People are scared. I talked to one staffer in the House, an energy advisor to a very conservative Republican representative. He agreed to talk to me only if he was anonymous. He told me Republican staffers tend to buy the science more than members, because they're younger. But he estimates there's at least a few dozen Republicans in the House who agree with the science, but who would never say so. He also said something that Bob said, that if Republicans could vote their conscience on climate change, not have to worry about politics, you could pass climate change legislation today. The very hypothetical math here is that if you got all the Democrats to agree on something, you'd only need 17 Republicans to get a majority in the House. But here's how far we are from that kumbaya day. This House staffer told me that personally, he feels passionately about climate change, but he's never told his boss because he thinks he'd get fired. I said, "Fired? Do you really think you'd get fired?" He told me, "Look, I'm a good employee. Maybe I'd get one strike. But if people in our district knew I believed in climate change, and I'm his energy advisor, they would freak out. I'd be a liability. If that got out, the smart thing for my boss to do would be to fire me." Inglis does have a small but growing list of allies. His group's website showcases some of this stuff. In general, it's people with solid conservative credentials, but nothing to lose. Like, there's this video of Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State, George Shultz, showing off his new ride.
"And I have my electric car running on electricity from the sun. So I'm driving on sunshine. Take that, Ahmadinejad."
Some other notable folks on the site: a top economics advisor to Mitt Romney, two from the McCain campaign, Ronald Reagan's economics advisor and conservative icon, Art Laffer. But Inglis is the first to say, the thing he's trying to do, it's lonely, like being in an ongoing, nonstop search for friends.
"Hey, how are you?
Hey, Bob. Nice to meet you.
Craig?
Greg.
Greg.
Recently, I joined Inglis on a trip to the University of Kentucky.
Oh, they're there's chicken available. That's why people are here.
Watching him in person, what's totally apparent is just how hard he's trying.
Good to see you.
And just this one day that I'm following him around, Bob's schedule includes an appearance on conservative talk radio, a visit to a newspaper editorial board, several media interviews, a presentation at the University of Kentucky's law school in front of the UK Federalist Society, and then a big nighttime event with him and two other speakers. Bob and his staff said this Kentucky trip, this was the kind of event they really looked forward to. A red state, a southern state, a coal-producing state. This was the kind of place and the kind of audience that he's trying to reach.
Good evening and welcome to the University of Kentucky.
The evening events in the university's grand ballroom. It's this huge room, and there's a good-sized crowd, easily over 200 people. And the program, from start to finish, is custom-tailored to appeal to conservatives in pretty much every way you could possibly imagine. It starts with a respected climate scientist named Catherine Hayhoe, who also happens to be a devout Christian.
So science can give us a lot of facts, but in order to decide what to do with those facts, we have to look to our values, and my values come from my faith.
After her, there's a retired Army general from Tennessee, a self-described conservative Republican, who makes a case that climate change and fossil fuels, they're a national security risk. Bob is the closer, with a speech designed for climate skeptics. At the center of his speech is this pitch to do this thing that all kinds of economists, liberal and conservative, say would reduce greenhouse gases. And that's to tax carbon, tax CO2 emissions. Bob clearly knows this isn't an easy sell to conservatives.
Now, there's a real problem with saying carbon tax. If you say it to a conservative audience, which is our target audience, conservatives break out in hives when you mention the word carbon, and they go into anaphylactic shock when you mention the word tax. And so you need EpiPens available to revive them, get them back breathing. But to hang with me now, after the second point, which is attaching a cost to carbon, comes a third point, which is cut taxes somewhere else an equal amount, dollar for dollar reduction in some other tax. So there's no growth of government.
There's more to it, but that's the gist of it. Tax pollution and then cut taxes on income. Bob says even if you're a conservative who doesn't believe the scientific evidence for climate change, that idea makes sense. You should still be able to get behind it. The thing you want more of, tax that less. The thing you want less of, tax that instead. So cut income taxes, tax pollution instead. At all his Kentucky events, Bob says all kinds of things to remind conservatives. I'm one of you. He bashes unions, he calls Social Security a Ponzi scheme, name drops Milton Friedman, talks about his Christianity. For over an hour, all three of the panelists hustle, like they know they're underdogs, like they know the crowd's against them. Bob wraps it up at about 8 o'clock, the end of a 14-hour day for him.
Give me an amen, I'll stop preaching. Thank you very much.
After all three speeches, they open it up for questions. And this is when things change. One student makes a comment to the general about how the U.S. should get out of Afghanistan, and the room cheers. A few questions later, Bob's urging the Kentucky crowd to call their senators, Rand Paul, Mitch McConnell, to make the kind of pitch he's talking about, conservative to conservative. And the audience responds like those guys are some sort of joke.
Talk to Rand Paul. Let me tell you.
And at around this point, I was just like, oh, this isn't a bunch of conservatives. This is a room full of liberals. I followed Bob afterwards as he walked around meeting people from the audience. He was visibly tired, but he kept a smile on his face, shaking hands and being friendly until the last person had left the room. It felt a little mean to point out that this wasn't the crowd he expected. So I said instead,
so how do you feel like that went?
I wish we had a lot more conservatives. We're hearing mostly from left of center.
Of course, Bob knew. It wasn't the first time this had happened. It turns out to be a recurring problem for him. Bob wants to have difficult conversations with conservatives about climate change. And he's doing that, for sure. But often, he finds there's another audience out there, an audience eager to hear a conservative say, conservatives are wrong about climate change. They love it. And that audience, his natural fan base right now, a fan base he's not super interested in, is liberals.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
1971 was the year. Seems like yesterday to me. Let me tell you about what happened then, back in the my country. We were fighting hard to build a union, 'cause at 40 cents a ton, there was no way to feed a family when the mining day was done. The strike had lasted for a year when they shot down Smiling Sid. He was a lawman who stood up for us miners. That's the only crime he ever did. 100 miners locked up with no trial there in Mingo Town. But the last straw came in Sharples when they gunned the women down. Now we're marching on to Mingo, 10,000 men and counting, here in the hills of West Virginia. At the Battle of Blair Mountain. We shouted through the hillsides in every Union hall. We're marching on to Mingo, teach them a lesson once and all. We commandeered every freight train to the Kentucky line. Took every car that crossed our path and all the guns and ammo we could find. The Union leaders tried to stop us. Mother Jones told us to turn back, but we had learned ourselves from the gun thugs. There's a time to talk and a time to attack. We had no leader, we didn't need one. We all knew our way through Logan County, and we all knew once we got there, we're gonna hang Sheriff Chapin from a sour apple tree. We're marching on to Mingo, 10,000 men and counting, here in the hills of West Virginia. At the Battle of Blair Mountain. For 3 days and nights we fought them. The front was 10 miles wide. Every cop and scab in West Virginia was there on the other side. They dropped explosives from their airplanes, such a thing you never saw. They shot us with machine guns. It was the operator's law. We dug trenches and wore helmets that we brought from the Argonne. All the way from France to Logan, we'd fought from dusk to dawn. President Harding sent in the army, and we left our line to them. But the hills of West Virginia will long remember when we were marching on to Mingo, 10,000 men and counting, here in the hills of West Virginia, at the Battle of Blair Mountain.
Ben Calhoun is one of the producers of our show. Act three, find an enemy. So now we move from the Republicans to the Democrats. I would argue that the guy on the left who is doing more than anyone to reinvent the politics of climate change, to give our entire national conversation about it a good hard shove, is named Bill McKibben. Last summer, McKibben published an article in Rolling Stone magazine that was basically a manifesto for how to do this. He notes that there is a weird silence about the subject of climate change. It's back burner. Over half of all Americans tell pollsters that they are worried about global warming, but that worry is not getting channeled toward any particular action to fix things. McKibben says that the problem with the political strategy so far is that it's mostly asked people to do something that they feel very ambivalent about, to go green, to produce less carbon dioxide personally. As he points out, we all like cheap airfares on airplanes that spew emissions. He writes, quote, "Since all of us are in some way the beneficiaries of cheap fossil fuel, tackling climate change has been like trying to build a movement against yourself. It's as if the gay rights movement had to be constructed entirely from evangelical preachers, or or the abolition movement from slaveholders. And he says those of us who bite the bullet and actually buy a hybrid car or those coily light bulbs that use less electricity,
you can't help but look at your new light bulb and think, you know what, I don't think this is going to solve climate change. And you're right to think that.
You write in your article, people perceive correctly that their individual actions will not make a decisive difference in atmospheric concentration of CO2.
Yeah, you can't make the math add up that way.
He says the other thing that should be clear to everybody at this point is that trying to explain the problem better, sending scientists to Capitol Hill, making a strong case for action, trying to win over the doubters, that has not been effective at getting legislative action. And he says it hasn't been effective because of political opposition. And he says the people who are pumping huge rivers of money into the opposition, funding studies to confuse the issue and funding anti-climate change organizations, and especially funding politicians who do not budge still on climate change, are the oil and gas and coal companies, whose products, of course, produce lots of CO2. Their role is well documented and not a secret at all. Those industries fought to kill the 2009 cap and trade bill. They funded a multi-million dollar lobbying effort that successfully kept the Senate from ratifying or even voting on the Kyoto Protocol, which was the first binding commitment on greenhouse gases in international law. But, and this is what's new about McKibben's approach, McKibben says that having an enemy like this is not a bad thing. He wrote in his manifesto that rapid political change requires a true political movement and, quote, movements require enemies. As John F. Kennedy put it, he writes, the civil rights movement should thank God for Bull Connor. He's helped it as much as Abraham Lincoln. Enemies, McKibben writes, are what climate change has lacked. And last fall, McKibben hit the road to sound the alarm that climate change, in fact, does have an enemy, and to organize an army against that enemy. His goal? To turn the oil and gas and coal companies into pariahs, like cigarette companies, as a way to destroy their political clout.
Thank you all enormously.
Boulder, Colorado, stop 21 on a 22-city tour, an 1,100-seat hall that, like usual on this tour, has loads of college students and, like usual, is sold out. McKibben himself is a 50-something with a runner's build and wire-rimmed glasses. On stage, he looks perennially like he is just about to get comfortable. He chops his arms up and down to punctuate his sentences.
You can tell from watching me that I'm not really a trained orator or activist or something. This is not what I'm great at, okay? I'm a writer, which is almost the opposite of, you know.
His road to the stage began in the 1980s as a young reporter for the New Yorker magazine. He wrote the first book for a general audience on global warming. It was called The End of Nature, and published a long excerpt in the magazine.
When I was 27 and I wrote The End of Nature, my theory of change was people will read my book and then they will change. Okay? Which turns out not to be how it works.
How it works, of course, is old-fashioned politics, organizing people. And McKibben started to switch roles from reporter to activist in 2006 when he noticed that nobody else seemed to be doing this when it came to global warming. He says he set out on this current campaign after he saw some numbers that were sobering even for him, somebody who's followed this issue for decades. He tells his audience that everything they need to know about the climate issue just comes down to these few key numbers. The first is 2 degrees Celsius. The world's governments agreed in 2009 at the UN climate meeting in Copenhagen that if the Earth's temperature rises 2 degrees more than it was before global warming kicked in, we're screwed. Just exactly how screwed, of course. How quick the ocean rise, how bad the hurricanes and droughts and food shortages, that's all a guess. But 2 degrees is the red line that the world agreed on.
Everybody signed it. The EU, Japan, Russia, countries that make their living selling oil, the United Arab Emirates, the most conservative, reluctant, recalcitrant, China signed. Even the United States signed on to this thing.
When you calculate exactly how much carbon dioxide it would take to drive up the planet's temperature 2 degrees, and there's a famous and frequently cited 2009 study which does just this, you learn that if the world keeps producing carbon dioxide at the rate we're going now, in just 14 years, we'll produce enough to send the planet up 2 degrees.
Which is very bad news, of course.
And McKibben says even more frightening is when you look at all the coal and oil and gas that has already been discovered, that we know about and is sitting there right now waiting to be pumped out and used. When you calculate how much carbon dioxide that stuff will release, it is 5 times more than the amount that would get us to 2 degrees. 5 times more. And this, says McKibben, is why the companies sitting on those reserves should be branded as pariahs, as an international global menace, because they do, in fact, plan to pump that stuff out and sell it, In fact, the financial markets are counting on them to do that. Their stock price is based on turning those underground assets into revenue.
I mean, if they carry out their business plans, the planet tanks. Exxon alone, one company, has 7% of the carbon in its reserves necessary to take us past that red line. What these numbers show is that the fossil fuel industry is now a rogue industry, determined to do things that everybody who studies this knows are unwise, unsafe, crazy.
At the end of every talk on his 22-city tour this fall, McKibben asked the students in the audience to rise to their feet and join a divestment campaign to get their colleges and universities to sell off their fossil fuel stock. It's a strategy modeled on the campaign against South Africa's apartheid government in the 1980s, which South African leaders have said was instrumental in helping push the regime into negotiations to end apartheid.
Look around at each other. This is what movements look like.
The idea that divesting of a company stock, particularly our stock, speaking as a longtime employee of ExxonMobil, to me that is not a very wise decision. We're a very good investment.
When I called ExxonMobil, the world's largest oil company and the world's most profitable company of any kind, they seemed positively happy for a chance to comment about McKibben's campaign. The press office set me up with Ken Cohen, who's in charge of governmental and public affairs for ExxonMobil worldwide. Can I ask, when you read something like this Rolling Stone article where he's trying to make the case that the oil companies should be treated like the cigarette companies, do you kind of roll your eyes and feel like, seriously?
That's a very good – yeah, that is how I feel. It is – it's trying to make a very complicated subject trivial. And to me, it's insulting to particularly in a university setting, to students and faculty. It is not getting at all at what the debate and discussion should be about.
These days, it's important to note that ExxonMobil acknowledges that climate change is real and that mankind's emissions have an impact. And this may surprise you. Since 2009, ExxonMobil has supported a carbon tax, the same type of carbon tax that McKibben calls for. But Cohen says that McKibben oversimplifies when he acts like, oh, let's just switch from fossil fuels to something else and we can do that in 14 years. He says that even if you make a heroic increase in the amount of electricity produced by wind and solar power, won't be enough by then.
It is totally unrealistic to think that we would have substitutes for the current energy sources. They just do not exist.
But when it comes to the numbers at the heart of McKibben's argument, the numbers showing that if Exxon and other companies simply sell what is in their reserves, they will drive up the planet's temperature far more than 2 degrees, I asked Cohen and his PR guy and the press people at the oil industry lobbying group, the American Petroleum Institute, several times for anything they might have that would dispute those numbers. And they didn't come up with anything. Finally, Exxon sent me to an industry-funded expert at MIT who told me not only that McKibben's numbers were solid, but that in fact, at current rates of emissions, by the end of the century, will probably raise the planet's temperature 5 degrees.
Some comes from slavery as well. Slave woman is taking care of the owner of the plantation's child, and she makes mention of her own baby she's had to leave by herself. It's called All the Pretty Little Horses. Hush-a-bye. Don't you cry. Go over, sleepy little baby.
When you wake,
you shall have
pay
all your
pretty little horses.
Blacks and gray, dapples and bay.
All the pretty little horses.
Way down yonder.
In the middle lane.
There lies
one little black baby.
butterflies.
He's in the butterfly.
Picking on my baby's eye.
Picking on my baby's eye.
Whoa,
my baby,
crying for him,
man, man.
But you got your blacks, you got your greens, you got them dapples, you got them babes. Oh, oh, oh,
all the pretty little horses.
Now for something completely different.